this is Paul. Welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School. My guest today is Alina Melamed, who takes us inside the world of professional ballet. She was in the Corps de Ballet of the American Ballet Theater, basically a professional dancer. And her story struck me for several reasons. First of all, what is required to produce that grace and magic you see on stage? Second, what are the lessons more universally about the sacrifice entailed in doing anything extraordinary? And lastly, at what point in your life do you look at a certain work or activity or relationship and say, enough, this no longer works for me. I need to make a change. We don't have many of those decisions in our lives, but we do have them, and they are critical. And all these things are something that I definitely didn't learn in school, and I'm really thrilled to share with you. And so with that, thanks for listening, and let's get into our conversation. For those people who don't know you, and probably ballet fans might, but why don't you step back a little bit and describe who you are, where'd you grow up, how'd you come to be where you are now?
Oh, wow, that's a long story.
Yes.
I was born in Israel, moved to New York City at the age of very young, I don't know, 3, 4, 5. Didn't speak a word of English. And so also was had very bad hips. I was born with a dislocated hip. Doctors told my mom I would always walk with a limp. I had a cast on for the first year of my life. My mother was very wise and thought, didn't accept that and thought ballet would help me. So when we moved to America, I didn't speak English and I needed to strengthen my hips. So my mother put me into ballet classes.
So it's one thing if just a mom says ballet will cure your hip. Like if I think about what ballet dancers do to their bodies, I'm not thinking, like right off the bat, I'm not like hip cure.
My mother was a lifelong ballet fan and ballet dancer, not professionally, but she danced through medical school.
Wow.
My mother's incredible. She was one of the first only women or, you know, I don't remember first or only, but very early on admitted into NYU medical school. Like she herself is a trailblazer, worked in the emergency room at Bellevue, basically raised us as a single mom. But anyway, she, having done ballet most of her life, understood, I think not just the benefits for me physically, because it is very strengthening in many ways.
Yes.
Also the discipline, the work ethic, all of the good stuff. And she just loved ballet and I didn't speak English. So frankly, I think it was the only place she could put me after school where she knew I could sort of find my way around without speaking for the first few months where we were there. And then I really took over and was the one pushing to do more and more of it.
Ballet is an unbelievably beautiful art form and also brutal. Why, like if you step back and think, why are people so, I have my theories, but you're the person who's the expert. Why are people so captivated by ballet?
Several reasons. For me, ballet is ethereal. It is an escape. Whether or not it's the Nutcracker, which is more geared towards little children, and there's candy everywhere, and there's sugar plum fairies, and it's sort of like our fantasies taken up a notch because, at least my perspective, you've never seen anything so beautiful and effortless. And communication in a way that is so clear and yet without words. And to see the physical body and the physical embodiment of something like Giselle is a great example, right? Giselle is a ballet about a woman who goes crazy and dies. I mean, she loses her mind, literally. And to see that without words, you really need to, as a dancer, embody it from your hair to your fingertips to your entire body. And so as an audience member, you feel it, right? It is acting to the 100th degree because you cannot use words. And so I think that really moves people and it sort of transcends you to this universe where you don't need words. You are feeling through music and through movement. And that is a very different, almost, experience that gets you in the gut, right? At least it does for me.
That's very visceral. So I took you off course. Your mom is working as a doctor. You were put in ballet school from a very young age. Can you fill in the blanks there a little bit?
So I fell in love with ballet. And actually, my mother took me to see the Nutcracker, New York City Ballet's version at Lincoln Center. We sat way up top, like in the, you know, nosebleed section. So we couldn't see faces or very much, but it transformed my life. I mean, as to what I was speaking to before, I had never seen anything so beautiful. I had never heard a live orchestra. And it was so moving. And to see all of the scenery and the dancing and the joy,
right,
it really moved me. I got out of my seat. I was dancing. You know, the usher kept telling me to sit down and I couldn't sit down. And I just, to this day, I remember that feeling. And it was like in my bones. I could not contain myself. And it was very clear to me that that was where I was meant to be. And New York City Ballet uses children from the School of American Ballet in their production of The Nutcracker. And I am a very determined person today. I was then too. I was 6 years old. And I would not relent until my mother allowed me to audition for the School of American Ballet, which is a professional training program in New York City. And finally, she took me to the audition. We waited in line for like 2 hours. I remember it so clearly. And we got to the front. And a woman who later I got to know very well, Mrs. Finn was her name, looked at my age on the form. And she said, well, you're too young. You can't audition. And my mother was like, are you kidding me? We just waited in this line. Like, just let her take the audition so she knows what to expect. We'll come back next year. So Miss Finn was like, okay, that's fine. So I did the audition. And my mother didn't, we were supposed to call a week later to see if you got in. My mother didn't even call because we were told I wouldn't get in. And then the school called us a couple of weeks later. And they said, Alina has a spot. Is she going to attend? And my mother was like, there must be some mistake. No, you said you were not going to take her. She's too young. And I'm standing there, Mom, shut up, shut up. Just tell him I'm coming.
So wait a minute, though. But this is so, I mean, you had some training, I guess, from 3 to 6. But there's, I mean, there must be thousands of people who are competing for these spots. And then you had something unbelievable that I guess distinguished you, even at 6, from everybody else who was applying. This, I mean, for the there were 0 spaces for 6-year-olds. I can't imagine there were that many spaces for 7-year-olds. So it was like 1 in 10,000 type of thing.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
I would like to think that I was very talented, but, you know, at that age, it's sort of, it's about your physique. Could you even be a ballerina? They test your hips. They test your feet. They test your flexibility. They have you dance across the floor just listening to music and improvising to see your musicality, to see your quality of movement. And I think a lot of it is probably luck, you know. Did you have a good day that day? I'm not sure. It obviously becomes much, much more competitive the older you get because every year a lot of girls do not make it to the next level. So it gets progressively harder and harder as you proceed.
So you begin there at 6 and then you're just dancing continuously until like when, what's the equivalent of professional level for dancing? What is that cutoff?
Well, I started at 7 the next year. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. I sort of think, you know, perfect. Like, when did I get into a ballet company? Mm-hmm. At 17. Mm-hmm. But even at the 8, I made my debut at Lincoln Center when I was 8. Mm. Right, dancing in the Nutcracker, mm-hmm. The very performance that had inspired me. From my perspective, I had been a professional dancer from the time I was 8. You are required to have a professional approach even at 8 when you perform, right? Nutcracker is 8 shows a week. Now they have 2 casts, but for an 8-year-old, you're doing 4 shows a week, sometimes 2 shows a day, in addition to your academics. Mm. You know, it is a grueling pursuit. And from the age of 8, every year, I performed in 2 or 3 productions with the New York City Ballet. So I got into a ballet company when I was 17, but I think that my professional career began much sooner.
And so what was it, what was it like, all that work?
Hard, very hard. Joyful. For me, there was nothing better than being on stage. Probably to this day, I don't know that I have found professionally anything equivalent to the satisfaction and the joy and the happiness, you know, the bliss that I felt as a performer on stage. But there was also an ugly side. There were a lot of challenges. And a lot of pain. I mean, you are physically and emotionally, right? You are thrust into a professional environment at the age of 8 when you don't understand the world. You don't understand emotions. You don't understand feedback, you know? And this is a professional training school. They're not there to hold your hand and pat your back and right. You know, so I think it's true for athletes. You know, I spent a lot of time thinking about this because ironically now my daughter does ballet in my same ballet school. And so I do spend a lot of time thinking about, is it good or is it bad? You know, was this good for me? Was it bad for me?
Yes.
And so I think there are pluses and minuses, as with everything in life. The pluses are, wow, you learn to work hard. You learn respect. You learn the power of being something, part of something greater than you. You learn work ethic goes without saying, right? You learn sacrifice. You learn determination and grit. And you really have to dig deep. Right? This really has to be driven from the inside somewhere, because the amount of sacrifice, the amount of pain, the amount of rejection that you go through, you're not going to make it unless you really want it. Right?
Right. So let's get into both pieces of that. So I had a former professional basketball player on who was also very humble, hard work and all that type of stuff. But I was like a little bit like, wait, what does it feel like to sink a 3-point shot to win the game and have thousands of people jump on their feet? And he was like, pretty good. And so I imagine, like, take us in a little bit that feeling, like, we'll talk about all the hard work and the difficult sides. And obviously you were in a documentary, we ought to get into all of that as well. But
yeah,
I got to imagine, for being a little girl and saying, like, I want to be part of this, then to actually being one of the people who creates the magic trick on stage, learns to do it, and then lands the jump and has the audience go completely haywire, I mean, it just must be amazing. Most people definitely are going to be spectators as opposed to participants. So describe what it's like to be on the receiving end of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was saying. I don't know how to describe it, Paul. And to this day, I don't know that I've found an equivalent. Mm. It is the admiration and the support, right? Like, that goes without saying. But also, you have worked your butt off for so many years, and you have visualized this moment. You have dreamt of this moment. Like, I'll never forget when I did my first principal role with ABT, and it was opening night, and I did the dress rehearsal, and it was really hard technically. And in the dress rehearsal, I missed every single turn. I mean, it was a disaster. I remember the director came to me and he was like, did you get that out of your system? You ready now?
Oh my goodness. How old are you at this point?
I was probably like 20.
So this is close to the peak of your career at this point?
Yeah.
You're the probably. Principal ballerina for American Ballet Theatre.
Well, I was not a principal. I was in the corps de ballet, but I was given the opportunity to do a principal role.
Got it. All right.
And you go back to your dressing room, and literally, this is what you do from the age of 7, is you are picturing yourself in that role, right? When I was at the school, I was picturing myself in every single role, and I was dreaming about it. I would go to sleep thinking about it. I would wake up in the morning thinking about it. If I wasn't in class, you're watching videos about it. You're doing the dance in your mind, right? So never mind the admiration that you're getting when you're on stage and you get that feedback from the audience. For yourself, it is a sense of accomplishment that I think very few people can actually say that they have gotten, right? I don't know if it's true maybe in other industries, like right. Now, Paul, we work in finance, or, you know, like maybe if you hit your return every year or something, like maybe I'm exaggerating, but at that young of an age, to have dreamt of something, to have sacrificed almost every normal kid thing, right? And to have
right.
your family sacrifice almost everything. I mean, my sisters were dragged to every performance because my mother couldn't afford a babysitter, right? They're sitting there backstage doing their homework. Like, there is so much that goes into this. And so then in that moment, when you are on stage and you hit it, it is euphoria. And you are sharing that with thousands of people in the audience that are celebrating with you. And
did you hit it in this specific performance that you're talking about? Were you goofed up the...
Yeah, thank God I did. It was opening night of our City Center season. And it was probably the most difficult technical role I had ever danced in my career. And the pressure was insane. I was a member of the corps de ballet. The other principals were principal dancers, and I messed up that dress rehearsal so badly. And thankfully I remember I almost blacked out. Like, I had an entrance where I had to walk on the stage very, very slowly. And I was so nervous. I don't even remember walking out on stage somehow.
Like, oh my goodness.
You get to center stage and the lights are on you, and this is what you've been training for literally every day of your life, right? For 10 years for that mm-hmm. moment. And you deliver. And you deliver because every single day you have trained your body what to do, and you've trained your mind what to do in those high stress, high pressure situations. And, yeah, so it was one of my greatest professional accomplishments, probably, was that performance. It was a real gift that they cast me in it and that I was able to deliver.
Let's now get into the difficult sides of this. I don't know whether you agree with this. It seems like it's basically the life of a professional athlete. Not a professional athlete getting paid $20 million a year, but a professional athlete in terms of the extreme punishing for your body. And it feels like, obviously, inactivity is not good for you, mm-hmm. but excessive activity is not necessarily good for you either. And there's a sort of defiance, basically, of laws of physics, gravity among them, that you're sort of putting yourself through all the time.
It's really physically enormously difficult. Dancers are injured all the time from a very young age. You have to learn how to use your body in a way that it is not meant to be used at all, right? We are not built to stand on our toes. We are not built for our hips to be ground and turned out all the time. Men are not built to be picking up women all the time over their head. And there's a lot of work that goes into that, and there are a lot of physical requirements dancers, a typical day for a dancer is you wake up, you ice your injuries, you take class, you go to physical therapy, you rehearse, you go to get a massage, and not like a fun massage, a really painful professional athlete massage where they're like digging into your muscles with their elbows. And then after that, you go to physical therapy and do some more, you know, it's constant. And then you perform, and then you go home, and again, you're icing, you're sewing your point shoe. Like, it is a grueling, nonstop, every aspect of your day is devoted to your art. There is no time for anything else, and that's from a very young age, right? And so, you know, when we're talking about some of the challenges, physically, very, very challenging. But you can imagine also beyond that, as a child, you really develop your sense of self in a world where all you know is right. ballet. Similar to, I think, how gymnasts train and figure skaters, yeah. athletes, right? Anything you're doing at that level is so demanding that you don't know anything else.
Right.
That makes it really challenging because your entire sense of self-worth, your entire definition of who you are, is all in this world.
Right.
From my perspective now as an adult and having a daughter, I think it's really unhealthy, right? Society wants to put us in a box anyway. It's like child actor, right?
Yeah.
But even more so when you're training at this level from a very young age, you're in that box. And to succeed, you got to stay in there. There's no time to, oh, I'm going to do a class, you know, roller skating. First of all, you can't, but you can't ski. You can't do any other athletics. You can't. I was never allowed to do gym class. You just can't risk getting injured. You can't have the wrong muscles. You can't, you know, like I couldn't even take spin classes after a while, even though they were my favorite thing to do because it made my thighs too bulky. Like every single thing in your life is defined by your art and your job. Imagine if that was the case, right, for all professions. I mean, we'd all, it's a very limiting experience in some ways, but to go through that as a child, when you don't, you're not old enough or mature enough to know that there's a whole other world out there.
Right.
I think it's challenging. The other thing about being a child in that environment, which is ironic, I think, is you're really, you don't have a voice. Mm. Like the way that you have to train, you have to defer completely to your coaches, right? Mm-hmm. And if they say, do it this way, you do it that way. If they say, lose 10 pounds, you gotta lose 10 pounds. If they say, like, you know, dye your hair doesn't look good on stage, I'm just making this up. Mm. There's no, you know, and you're a kid too. So it's very different than going to a school where you're encouraged, like academic school, I mean, where you're encouraged to question and you're encouraged to challenge and to ask, why is that? What, you know, when you're training for any athletic type of job, you have to listen to your coaches, right? That's why athletes and dancers are, you know, we're so good at following rules and we're so successful because you tell us what to do, we're going to do it. We're going to find a way to do it.
How do you net out on it then? Because it does seem like there's basically lots of things that occupy our time that are sort of like the modern version of gladiators. Like gladiators filled stadiums. It was clearly something in the human, we're not that different. We're not wired differently than we were then, where watching these people take on a lion and somebody's going to die and it's either going to be a lion. There's something about that that is in our wiring. And the Tour de France or basketball or ballet are different flavors of that. So that seems primitive. But on the other hand, we're attracted to it. You, as somebody who was right in the center of it, after all this reflection, where do you come out?
That's a pretty stark comparison of ballet to gladiators. Nobody dies in ballet, hopefully.
The modern versions are not quite as extreme as gladiators, but there's still, but in these, you know, anyways, they come close.
No, it's a really interesting comparison because dancers are sacrificing so much to be up on that stage.
Yes.
Let me tell you. And they are working so hard.
Yes.
For our enjoyment, right? an hour being the audience. Mm. I think the ballet world has changed a lot. I think the entire world has changed a lot, right? So I'm speaking, I hope it has. I'm speaking about, you know, 30 years ago. I would say that there is in any art so much beauty and so much importance, especially in our world today, that the dancers deserve our appreciation and they deserve the recognition, which I think is very lacking in all that they do to bring that to us. And where I net out is I would be a really, really sad person if I could not go see Giselle in a couple of weeks, if I could not go see Swan Lake.
Right.
Because there is more joy and more beauty than there is the hardship, right?
The hardship, and particularly with ballet, there's sort of sub thread here of basically really unhealthy food issues that are part of this. And you were part of a documentary where this was discussed, and you just mentioned that you couldn't spin because it would add weight to your thighs type of thing. So just take us in that world a little bit, if you would.
Well, again, I think the world has changed a lot. I know it has. And this is not unique to ballet, right? I just want to make that clear. This is true for every athlete. Unfortunately, when your body is your instrument, your body has to look a certain way,
right?
And your body has to be able to do certain things. And that's just a brutal reality of using your body for your profession. Just putting that out there, like, it is not, I'm not, I don't think that this was evil or, you know, nobody sets out to hurt people or anything. It is just, unfortunately, the reality of this type of work. Your body has to look a certain way. And that is why, just taking a pivot for a second, when I retired from ballet, I wanted to do something that in no shape or form would rely on my physical appearance or my body. We'll get to that later.
Interesting.
But that's just the reality of any athlete, right? You need to look a certain way. You need your body to do a certain thing. And not all dancers struggle with weight at all. I happen to. It was challenging for me from a very young age to keep my weight where it had to be at that elite level. Part of that is, listen, you're going through puberty, you know, like, and to what I was saying earlier, anytime your entire self-worth and your entire identity is tied up in your profession and being a ballerina.
Right.
And then somebody tells you, actually, you can't really be a ballerina unless you lose some weight. That immediately then becomes the end of the world, right? And it becomes a statement as to your self-worth and your future. And it's so much more, right, than just, oh, I'm, you know, my pants are tight, I'm just gonna like loosen it. It's like everything you've been working for every single day of your life for the past 10 years is not gonna come to fruition unless you lose 10 pounds. That's a very different reality. And when you're very young and that's what you're faced with, and again, not in a bad way, right? Like, it's just, it is what it is. Dancers, you know, I think today there's much more of a spectrum of what dancers should look like.
Oh, interesting.
But in those days it was pretty narrow and it was challenging for me to get there. And I developed a lot of unhealthy eating habits. Again, you're 13, 14, but, you know, it's a lot of pressure. And so I've been very open. I always struggled with eating disorders as a teenager. There were a lot of ups and downs emotionally and physically in terms of my weight. But I learned very quickly, actually, after I got into ABT, and I was already getting help for my eating disorder at the time, I just learned very quickly that it was, for me, it was so much more, it was so connected to how I valued myself and how I identified myself, that I really, like, it wasn't about food, it was, or, you know, control or looking a certain way, really it became, do I believe in myself? Mm. Do I value myself? Can I believe in myself enough to get better, if that makes sense? And do it in a healthy way while I'm still on stage, expected to look a certain way, right? It's actually very challenging because I couldn't just start eating and put on 20 pounds. I would have lost my job. It was a really, really difficult thing to do. How do you recover from an eating disorder and try to learn to eat healthy and value yourself and believe in yourself while still looking like a professional ballerina so you don't lose your job, which is the job that you've wanted your entire life and fought for and is the only thing really that you care about at that age, right? Like, so it was very challenging, Paul. I will say I was so lucky that the director of ABT, Kevin McKenzie, was wonderful to me. Mm-hmm. I had reached a point when I, very early on to my career at American Ballet Theatre, where I did start putting on some weight because, again, I was trying to, you know, figure out the balance. And I was asked to lose weight before our major season. And I thought, oh, what am I going to do? Like, here we go again. I was just getting better. You know, what? How am I going to manage this? And people who know me know that I just can't not be honest. Like, mm-hmm. I just, I can't keep things inside. So here's little, like, you know, 17-year-old apprentice. I made an appointment with the director, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, apprentices don't talk to the director. But I was like, no, I need to talk to him. And I sat in his office and I was so nervous. And I said, I'm just going to be totally honest with you, Kevin. I'm struggling from an eating disorder. And if you keep asking me to lose weight, I'm not going to be able to because it's too much pressure. And this is my dream to be dancing here with you. And I'm surrounded by all of these gorgeous dancers. And I need time. I need time to be able to do this in a healthy way. And he gave me such a gift. He completely destigmatized it, right? And he said, Alina, I'm so happy you were honest with me. He said, I have to say it, nobody's ever been that blunt and honest. And he said, I get it. I'm gonna treat this as if you have Achilles tendonitis. And we're gonna come up with a time frame and we're gonna work together and I'm gonna give you your time and you're gonna figure it out and it's gonna be fun. And in that moment, you can imagine what a weight was lifted off of my shoulders, right? Because first of all, you never know how people are going to respond when you're so honest about your struggles, right? And so for him to be completely matter of fact, I'm going to treat this like any other injury. I'm going to give you time and you're going to figure it out and it's going to be fine. It could have gone the other way.
Right. Very much dependent on who the person was in the seat.
I hear you say that not everybody struggles with it, but it seems to me it's a little bit like what I've read about like Tour de France riders. Yes, there's some people who naturally can ride for 5 hours and either they can eat what's required and not get heavy, or they just don't have that big of an appetite. That's a certain fraction of people, but it's like a tiny minority. The vast majority of them ride 5 hours, would like to eat 4 pepperoni pizzas, and can eat one, and then sit there hungry. And that's just, as you would say, what's required. So what percentage of ballet people are having to be super, just say, strict with their diet, as opposed to being, you know, putting the clinical labels on it? Wouldn't it be a lot of them?
Well, listen. No dancer is eating 4 pepperoni pizzas, right. I guarantee.
Right. So pretty much all of them, it's just a matter of degree.
Listen, your body is your instrument, and your body is doing incredibly difficult things, men and women.
Right.
They are watching what they eat.
Yeah.
Right? Well, all dancers have to. They are peak athletes, like every single day. I don't think people understand how grueling it is.
Right.
You are dancing from 10 o'clock in the morning until 11 p.m. at night, usually with just a couple of hours break in between. And you don't take days off. You have 8 shows a week. Mm. The rule of thumb is like for every day you take off, it takes like a week to get back into that peak condition. So dancers very rarely ever take time off. It's not enough just to be in the studio because that's not aerobic, the stop and start of rehearsals and of class. So usually dancers, in addition to all of the classes and rehearsals, are doing Pilates. They're doing exercise, whether or not it's swimming or CrossFit. The men, I mean, they're lifting weights all the time. Like, I don't think people fully understand how grueling and what these bodies go through, right, to be a dancer. So you can, I promise you that they're all watching what they eat, and they eat healthy, and their body is their temple, right? But not all dancers suffer from eating disorders. That's the distinction that I'm making. Some dancers are just naturally thin. And when you work out that much too, right? Like your body just,
right.
You know, some dancers can't put on enough weight. Like it's different for every dancer. I wouldn't want to generalize.
Got it. But for you, at a certain point, it got quite extreme, right? Before you got to that degree of maturity where you were able to say, hey, listen, this is the way it's going to have to work for me.
Yeah, I think it's much more challenging for younger dancers, right? In the ballet schools, sort of in the teenage years when your body is changing. And so I was always very, very thin when I was a kid. I never watched what I ate. I just could eat anything. And then when your body starts changing, that's not the case anymore, right? And then it's just like this vicious cycle. And that's why I was saying it wasn't even so much about like physically, I kind, you know, I'm tall. Like I was very lucky. I did actually have the physique. For me, it was more psychological and like almost like harming myself, right? Like trying to like use food as like a reward or punishment, because I was struggling so much as a teenager. I think most of the time when you get to the professional level, you figured it out, right? I think the more dangerous time
is before is the
training. And now it's very different. I mean, everybody's aware of it. All of the schools are aware of it. You know, it is, I think it's just a very different time.
Who realized that there was an issue? You or your mom or your instructors? Who was the person who clued in that and began to be like, wait a minute, something here needs to change. This is not healthy.
I think it was a combination of me and my mom. My mom is a doctor. She was very, very close to me. I was so lucky. She was such an integral part. I mean, she wasn't, you know, like in the studio with me, but she was a huge supporter. And it actually, you know, ironically, the way that I started really struggling with food was she took me to see a nutritionist because she saw that I was struggling with my weight, and I kept getting feedback that I had to lose weight. And, you know, when she took me to a nutritionist, the nutritionist taught me about food and healthy eating. And that's when I was like, oh, I could actually decrease my calories even more. Oh, I could actually just cut this out and then I'll get it, you know. So I was very lucky that my mother was always close, and I always had this nutritionist, you know, sort of in and out of the picture. But it really was my mother, and probably my sister too, who's now also a doctor, but all of us together were very close. And
what's your biggest piece of advice for people who might be listening to this and are wondering, like, what's the line between healthy and unhealthy?
Oh man, that's a really hard question.
You don't have to answer it if it's too hard. I'm just curious.
Healthy and unhealthy. I think so many people have an unhealthy relationship with food. It's not even eating disorder or not, right? Like if you are anybody who's saying that they're on a diet or counting calories, like I just wish that all of us accepted who we were without the external pressures or expectations of what we want to look like or what we think we should look like versus just who we are. we're all different, and that's fine. That, in my mind, is healthy.
What is the lifespan of a professional ballet person's life? How long can you, into what age can you do that before it just no longer becomes possible?
Very short. I would say most dancers probably retire in their 30s. Some now push into their 40s, which is remarkable to be on stage performing at that level. But probably late 20s, 30s. And then they go on, you know, you could also teach, you could choreograph, you could do other things in ballet. But a performance career, early 40s, I think is like, wow.
And so for you, when did you begin to say, okay, I think I've done enough of this?
So I, again, was very blessed because I had both of my parents who always ingrained in our narrative in the house that, okay, this ballet thing is great. If you want to do it, we'll support you, but you need a plan B. You know, that was always the narrative. So I went into it thinking, I'm going to try it. I'm going to give it my best. And then I'm going to do something else. I never pictured myself as a ballet teacher. I didn't have talent as a choreographer or a coach. I just knew that. Like, I would be a horrible teacher. I couldn't choreograph. There was nothing. I didn't really see anything beyond being a dancer. And so it was very clear to me that I was always going to go on to do something else. And after about 5 years in ABT, I had this, you know, I had actually, I don't want to say I conquered my eating disorder, but I was healthy. I was, I was in a great place. And I was doing like a guest appearance at like a smaller, you know, dancers with ABT are often invited to do guest appearances with smaller companies. And I was out of shape when I went to this place and I took a class and I was out of shape. I hadn't danced for a couple of weeks and, but you know, I thought I looked good. And the director came to me afterwards and they're like, oh, we're so happy. I actually think they wanted me to do Giselle. And we're like, so happy that you're here and we can't wait. And thank you. And at the end of the conversation, she looked at me and she said, but I just want to make sure you're going to like lose some weight before the performance, right?
Oh my goodness.
And it was almost like something took over me physically and mentally. And it was like this aha moment where I picked up my bag and I looked at her and I said, no, I am not going to lose weight and I'm not going to do the performance. It sort of was like, thank you, you know, very politely. And I left the theater and I was not, and I was in a foreign city. So I just got lost and I was walking around. And it occurred to me in that moment that as much as I loved dancing, Paul, and I loved it, there was nobody happier on the stage. Like I told you, that was say, my happiest place in the world. I hated being a dancer. I hated it. It was suffocating. It was, I had no voice. I had no agency. I had no control. It was the injustice of it. I couldn't stand that anybody had, never mind the director of American Ballet Theater, right? Like, okay, he could tell me something, but like, I couldn't stand it that anybody thought they had the right to tell me what my body should look like.
You're a part in somebody else's plan.
Yeah. And I,
in the most fundamental way, like down to what you're down to what you're eating.
It didn't matter how talented I was. It didn't matter how hard I worked. It was like until everybody had a say in my success and it was just based on what they thought my physical appearance should be. That's what it came down to, right? Because at a certain point, if you reach that level, everybody's incredibly talented who's in these companies, right?
Of course, they must be like superstars. Yeah.
And so, walking around that city, I was like, oh my God, this is never going away, right? Like I was in a great place. I was eating healthy. I was happy. And yet I was always going to have to defer and let other people tell me what they thought about my body and my weight.
Yeah.
And I just realized that was not going to be okay for me. And I didn't want to do it anymore. And it was the...
How old were you then?
I was 23, mm-hmm. 22 or 23.
Stressor, probably something about brain development too, in terms of, you know, different parts of your brain coming on online. It's difficult, impossible to have that perspective as a teenager.
That's what I was saying. Exactly. And it was also, Paul, the first time where I thought to myself, literally the first time, what would I do if I wasn't a dancer? And my mother had forced me to take my SATs uh-huh. 17, God bless her, and my father. Uh-huh. You know, they were always like, you got to keep your grades up, or we're not doing this. And so I thought, wait, I could go to college. Would I be wow. happy in college? What would I do after college? I'd never even thought about it. That's how myopic you have to be to train wow. at that level. And I pictured myself going to college and I was like, oh, I could be happy. Like maybe that would be interesting. Maybe I would really enjoy using my brain and not my body. And the second that I realized that I could be happy doing something else,
right.
I found my way back home and I called my mom and I said, I think I'm done. Like, I don't want to do it anymore. And it was very jarring because it was mid-season and she was like, well, why don't you finish the season? Go talk to ABT. You know, like, don't you want a farewell performance? And Paul, I just couldn't go back. It was like I had this aha moment and it was liberating. I never wanted anybody to be able to tell me what I should look like,
yeah.
what I eat, how I never wanted my value to be connected to my body and what I look
right.
like. And I just wasn't going to go back. And so I didn't. That was it.
I find this so fascinating because there's I've heard variations of this type of story, and I've experienced it in my own life too. These things that something is cooking and cooking and cooking beneath the surface, and then in like a fifth of a second, you're like, okay, that phase of life is over. And it's in so many different areas of people. You know, I know one person who, you know, was a spy. You're literally somebody else. And then one day he was like, I'm done. And, you know, people have this attitude, you know, some people experience it in their, in intimate relationships. Other people experience it towards alcohol or drugs or something like that. It's like, no. And I just find that this ability that we're sort of walking around, but then we have this deeper sort of water going underneath us where these things are percolating. And it's probably only a few times in life. And they could be for good or for bad. And they could be different types of, but boom, it's a radical yeah. switch. And you experienced one of those.
I did. And it was... You know, sometimes I think back to that time and I am so surprised at myself that you can think about, I was in my early 20s. I had no friends that were not dancers.
Right.
I had no community outside of ballet. I didn't know anything outside of ballet. I mean, literally not one friend that was not a dancer or somehow affiliated with the arts, you know? I had trained for 20 years every single day in the studio. And I think sometimes that the only way I could make that break and sort of survive without it being so sad was to do it really quickly and completely. I didn't want a goodbye. I didn't right. have to go back to that dressing room. I couldn't fathom going back on the stage because maybe I would change my mind because I yeah. did so much. You know what I mean? Like that would have almost made it harder. And so I made a complete break from that day. I flew, the company was in DC. I flew to the Kennedy Center. I had a meeting with Kevin. He was gracious, so kind. He couldn't believe it. He was like, you're out. Uh-huh. What? And I said goodbye to my friends. And then I made the mistake of actually... watch they were performing. I actually briefly went to the audience and they were doing the Nutcracker, which, you know, had a very special spot in my heart
right.
because it inspired me to do ballet. Right. And I lost it. And I was sitting there.
I bet.
In the audience next to a good friend of mine.
Just weeping.
And she held my hand. She said, "Are you okay? Do you need anything?" And I just got up and I left. And I never went back. Like, I mean, now I have many years later, but I didn't go back to the theater. I couldn't watch the ballet. I stayed in touch with my friends, but I would see them away from the theater. I couldn't even listen to ballet music. If I was in a store and Nutcracker music came on, I would leave the store. It was like having a broken heart. And in order to heal from it, I had to have a complete separation. And that's what I did for many years. I couldn't go back.
Now you look back on it, how has your perspective changed, both with the benefit of distance and also now being a mom and having a daughter who dances?
I mean, I was always incredibly grateful for my time as a dancer. Yeah. That hasn't changed. It was hard, but doing anything at that level is hard, right? That's why it's so rare. Mm-hmm. That's why.
Yes.
So I appreciate the challenges just as much as I appreciate the gifts that I got from that time. I got to live my dream. How many people get to say that?
Yes.
And so I am incredibly honored that I did that. It just feels so lucky. And even the hard times, they made me who I am.
Right.
And I was able to use, you know, I was in a documentary. I was able to use my challenges with the eating disorder to help so many other people, non-dancers.
Yeah, that's a very powerful documentary, by the way.
Thank you. It became such a huge part of what I could then give back. And so I have nothing but gratitude for my time as a dancer, despite or probably, you know, because of the challenges. Like, it made me who I am, and I see so much good that came out of it.
Has it changed the way your experience, how you sort of watch your daughter going through it?
Absolutely. First of all, my daughter healed me in so many ways. But when it comes to ballet, you know, I think that I always, because I left so abruptly, I healed, but I didn't like make up with my young dancer self. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I moved on from it, but I didn't fully accept that. And watching ballet through her eyes, because she just loved it from the time she came out of my body, she just was dancing. I couldn't stop her. And so I took her to see the ballet. The first time I was sat in the audience and watched some of my best friends to this day are dancers. You know, some of them are still with ABT.
But right.
Certainly 10 years ago when Lucy was born, or I took her, I think the first time I took her to see Swan Lake, she was like 3. Mm-hmm. And everybody was like, "She's going to sit through Swan Lake." I was like, "Oh yeah, she will sit through Swan Lake." She was obsessed. I got front row tickets. My good friend Jillian was dancing. And she, you know, just watching it through her eyes, it goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning, Paul. She was transfixed. Like, she was in another world. She had never seen anything so beautiful.
Yes.
And I could tell the music was taking over her body. And I took her backstage after, and she got to meet the swans, and her eyes.
Oh my God.
I fell in love with ballet all over again. I remember I loved it so much. I remembered all of the beauty and how it can uplift us, right? That's the whole point of art, to show us something that we wouldn't normally see, to show us the beauty, to transform our perception. And to watch that as a mother, to watch your child experience that, it was such a gift and really transformative for me. And now we go see the ballet. I mean, every season we go see it, you know, multiple times. And it's really taught me to appreciate the beauty of it.
You can sort of see the forest for the tree.
Yeah, for many years, I just remembered the hardship. And now I focus more on the beauty, and I hope that lasts, because it's hard being a mother to a dancer going through all of that.
the title of the podcast is Things I Didn't Learn in School. So biggest things you didn't learn in school about, you know, if you reflect back on this experience.
The most important thing, which I try to impart to my children too, is that there's not just one path. Hmm. And that's why I was always so grateful that my parents instilled in me, you need a plan B. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that even just for ballet. Like I look at kids today and just, you know, everybody thinks that there is one direction. You go to school, you get into college, you do this, you find a job, you know, like you go like this. Well, my life has never been that way. Even when I started my career in finance, as you know, I started in investment banking and private equity. Like I've made many pivots. I was an investor. Yeah. Then I worked with clients. Then I was an investor again. Now I'm doing corporate strategy. Like there is not one way to do anything. And I think that everybody asks, how did you go from being a ballerina to being investment banking? And to me, it was just, well, you reinvent yourself and you pivot. And you have to think about life not just as, oh, okay, this is what I'm going to do and that's it. It's hard when you're training as a dancer, right? Because that's really all you know. You're sort of in this box. Mm-hmm. But I wish somebody had told me, you know, you could, it's okay if you do this for 5 years and then you try something else. And
right.
I tell my kids that all the time. You don't have to go to college right after you finish high school. Like, try something. And then you could always go to college later. And then you could pick a career. And then you could say, actually, I don't like this career. I'm going to use what I learned here and do something else. You're doing that, Paul, right?
I am.
I wish more people, like, that's what I wish had been more acceptable when I was going through it. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I didn't, you know, fully grasp at the time was this gratitude and how lucky we are to have the good and the bad, that even being in a classroom and being in a school is a gift, right? And especially now post-COVID and everything that's happening in the world, just having a, taking a step back outside of ourselves, outside of our world, and to really fully understand how lucky we are, even when things are hard, even when times are tough or whatever, we're still probably some of the most lucky people in the world.
Yeah, it's what another guest who had lived through the Cultural Revolution in China reminded me that basically, particularly when something is taken away from you, and in his case, school, because he was a teenager when the Cultural Revolution was going on, and they got so hungry for information, they literally, their library had a dirt floor, so they tunneled under it and came up in the middle and got books and came out. And that's the thing, the appreciation for, it's just having something taken away. And COVID has done that in many different forms.
Very much. And the last thing is, I wish that there wasn't such a stigma about failing at something. You know, I failed a lot. As training, as a dancer, I didn't get into companies that I didn't want to get into. I didn't get some roles that a lot of roles that I wanted to get. I didn't make it to principal. You know, like I could list so many failings, but they were also gifts at the same time because they opened up other paths and other doors. And making mistakes and failing, I try and instill that in my kids, that everybody fails. And the trick is to fail well, right?
What almost seemed like the food thing, and maybe, you know, maybe this is not right, but it seems like the food thing, even though it was causes an enormous amount of pain, it's also the thing that gave you the clarity to make the pivot.
Completely. And had I not struggled with that, right, I would have had a very different life. Who knows if it was better or worse.
Yeah.
But you know, that too. I mean, I wish that somebody at that point in time had told me, you know what, I know this is really hard right now, and in 10 or 15 years, or, you know, like, you're not even gonna realize what your body looks like. You're going to have two kids. You're not going to care. Like, everything happens for a reason. embracing that and embracing change and trying to focus on the positive of it and using it for good
is worth a lot. Well, Lita, thanks so much for coming here and sharing your story. I do feel like we could talk for another couple of hours, but we're going to cut it off here and maybe we'll return with another conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul. This has been so fun.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much.
Today's podcast was produced and edited by Dave Manahan.